This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation about the week's news on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can always call us as well to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. We are joined, as always, by Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributor to ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Susan.
Good morning.
And Kevin Rennie. He's an attorney. He's a Hartford Current columnist, and he blogs at dailyructions.com. Hello there, Kevin.
Good morning.
Well, we're going to get to the governor's race, which is less than a week away. There's a lot to talk about in this last wheelhouse before we get to Election Day. We had a story that came up just yesterday, as a matter of fact, that has become the lead of our program. And I just want to give a little bit of a background to some of the things I'm going to say today. Many of you know that I grew up in Pittsburgh, but I don't think that everyone knows that my mom grew up in that Squirrel Hill neighborhood that has been in the news for the last couple days. That's a neighborhood that I know really, really well, and it has profoundly affected not only me, what happened on Saturday, but I think a lot of people from the Pittsburgh diaspora who I know in this area. It's affected an awful lot of people in that city, and I think that so much of what is happening in politics this week is being clouded and will continue to be clouded by the events of Saturday, the horrific shooting of 11 people who were in a service at their synagogue in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. So that's a little bit of a background for where we're headed first here, Colin, which is with a campaign mailer. It's a campaign mailer that came to our attention, I believe, probably Monday night. It came to the house of Jeff Cohen, who lives in Middletown, really close to Matt Lesser, and he is running for state senate. And I'm just wondering, Colin, if you can first try to describe for people who have not seen it what this mailer looked like and what it said.
Yeah, I can try. The most offending image, there's sort of two images on it. One of them is somebody trying to steal a piggy bank from, like, hands reaching for some guy's piggy bank. The more significant one is a distortion of Matt Lesser's face. Money, bills, have been photoshopped into his hands. His facial features have been digitally altered to make him appear to have a kind of leer of avarice as he holds this money. If you know what Matt Lesser looks like, he's barely recognizable in this. I think as we go along here in the days to come, I mean, we can talk very specifically about what was done to change his face around. It is pretty clearly, not even pretty clearly, this is clearly an attempt to depict Matt Lesser in an offensive way that's very familiar over hundreds of years of anti-Jewish propaganda. I mean, this goes back to the Merchant of Venice and before, when you, in a disparaging way, I mean, we have to sort of begin. This is meant to be a disparaging ad. There's no question about that. There's no debate about that.
His attack piece.
Yes, it's an attack piece. So it's a disparaging image. The disparaging image involves a Jewish man whose face has been altered to exaggerate certain facial characteristics and to give him this greedy leer. Money has been photoshopped into his hands. This isn't a Rorschach blot where we're all going to sit there and go, gee, well, I see an elephant. What do you see? There is just no question about what this is. And I actually think, from the point of view of the kinds of things that you're talking about, John, where the road that where this road ends, it ends in a long history of violence and genocide. The people who look at this and go, really? Because I don't really see that, you know, which was the Republican state chairman's first reaction, J.R. Romano's initial reaction before he went behind the scenes and probably got beat up a little bit by some people and had to come back and kind of walk the whole thing back. But his initial react was, wow, I just don't see Jewish there. I don't see anything Jewish about this. Those people are familiar, too, from the same sordid history that we're talking about. The people who deny the existence of anti-Semitism, who claim they don't see it when it is there with a big blinking red light. They are a big part of this hundreds of years old story, too. I'm sorry I'm not my usual jolly self this morning, but I'm having a real problem with this. And I just want to say, and we'll be going, there has yet to be a truly emphatic Republican rejection of this ad that I've seen anyway by anybody. Bob Stefanowski came out with a very vaguely worded statement that doesn't mention Lesser, doesn't mention this specific ad, and then pivots towards four paragraphs of denouncing Ned Lamont about something else. If somebody has like apologized to Matt Lesser, I have missed it. I mean, maybe somebody has. But if some Republican leader has apologized to Matt Lesser and said, this is not what we do, we will never do this, this is not us, I have missed it.
But before we get to our other panelists, let's actually hear from Matt Lesser. He spoke to our David DeRoche last night.
2 days after a horrific attack in Pittsburgh, the last thing we expected was to see something like this in Connecticut.
And here's the campaign treasurer of his opponent, Ed Sheremut. The treasurer's name is Alan Greenspan, responding to the charges of anti-Semitism. Alan Greenspan is also Jewish himself.
The ad came out, was designed about 2 weeks ago, long before the shooting in Pittsburgh. The intent of the ad is to show greed, taking the money from the individuals and putting it into the government. There was nothing in that ad that depicts anti-Semitism.
And he actually goes on to say some other things, Susan, including the fact that he was not depicted wearing a yarmulke. He was not depicted holding a Torah. He was not depicted with a Star of David. There's nothing in there that suggests Jewish. This is what he told our David DeRoche. Things that honestly just make your mouth kind of fall open when you hear them.
Yeah. And if you look at anti-Jewish propaganda that's come out over the years in many countries, including Nazi Germany. No, they don't depict Jewish people with Stars of David or a Torah or a yarmulke. They don't have to, because there are certain tropes and the avarice and that kind of with the grabbing of the money and the looks of greed. That's one of them. That is a trope that goes back, like Colin said, that goes back a long way. So I don't buy it. I don't buy it at all. And I know that the Republicans are going to try to say that, well, it was completely harmless. It was, you know, we didn't mean to do this. But really, I don't think so. And I think that they're kind of trying to have it both ways right now, where they're trying to pander to, they're trying to maybe wink at the anti-Semites in their base. And they are there. But they're also trying to, make sure that people understand that they're not really that threatening, so that moderates will still vote for them. And that's a very terrible line to walk.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Kevin, if you see this as someone who designed this ad. And let's just be clear here. This didn't come from the state party. This didn't come from a super PAC. This came from the campaign of Ed Sheremut, the guy who's running against Matt Lesser. So this was paid for in part by state dollars, because he's getting Citizens Election Program funding.
Aren't you all so pleased that we have public financing?
Each
one of you could have contributed to paying for this.
We'll get back
to and this. Yeah, go ahead. This is not the first time. Well, I'm going to say this.
Yeah,
not the first time. I have pointed out, when you finance campaigns, what it is your money is going to be spent on.
So that is a very good reminder of some of what your money is being spent on. Do you see it as an ad like this as winking at anti-Semites in the base, or do you see it as really, really bad history and people not understanding what images like this actually mean?
I think it was incredibly callous, and they may be, they may not think about these things. I think that it may be part of simply who they are, that it doesn't occur to them that this is anti-Semitic imagery that is hundreds and hundreds of years old, and no one says, hey, wait a minute, and these brochures usually go through a few people before they reach your mailbox. And
somebody has to say,
obviously,
no, that's okay. That looks good.
A few people will say that. Yeah. I just want to point out, though, anti-Semitism in politics is not only nothing new, it is going on right now around the world. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, who is the leader of the Labour Party, could be the next prime minister of Great Britain, is an anti-Semite. And he has associated himself with Hamas and has laid a wreath by the terrorists, the Munich terrorists. I mean, it was not that long ago that in Paris, at a Jewish delicatessen, terrorists went in and killed people there. It was only 4 years ago that Mark Greenberg, a Connecticut Republican, was the subject of other anti-Semitic imagery when the Democrats pointed out that he identifies as Jewish and then referred to him as a shady real estate developer. Again, that goes on all the time. This one caught our attention. Mm. But no one was raising a cry when Elizabeth Esty was associated with this in 2014.
Mm. Colin?
I do think one of the questions now is who did see this piece before it went out? I believe that Mr. Romano is saying that he didn't, if I understand his statement correctly, that he didn't okay it.
I think that's probably true because I think he's – other than having a title, he's a peripheral figure in most campaigns.
Right. So who did see it? Usually a lot of the contract work for this stuff kind of goes to the same shop. Often it's a shop with some political ties. So I'd like to know who designed it. I'd like to know who did see it. I think those are pretty relevant questions. And I do think that the Republicans certainly, you know, over the 24 hours of you know, this thing arrived in Jeff's mailbox on Monday, and so they really had all day yesterday as this thing brewed up, and it was retweeted by Chelsea Clinton, retweeted by Jake Tapper. It's in the Washington Post. It's in the New York Times. I mean, they knew all through the day yesterday they had a big problem on their hands. It was a problem that was going to spread outside Connecticut. And you know, they had time to develop a strategy, and there are various strategies. I mean, one thing that you could try to do if very few people okay this ad is just contain it to the area between Rocky Hill and Middletown and say, this is the guy, we don't, you know, this guy Chairman, I don't know, this is certainly not us. We would never do anything like this. You just throw him under the bus and say that this is not you. They haven't done that. You could profoundly apologize and say things happen in a rush sometimes and people don't really know, but this is horrible. We would never do this. We apologize to Matt Lesser. They haven't done that either. So they've really kind of allowed it to a certain degree by their silence or relative silence to tincture the entire state's Republican operation, which I don't think it needed to do. And we all know lots of Republicans here, and they're not anti-Semites in there. So I don't know why they didn't want to break ranks on this, but I think it's been a big mistake.
I will say that when the Hartford Courant reached out to J.R. Romano, the head of the state party, he said something very much like what he told our own David DeRoche about an hour later. This was his initial reaction.
Matt Lesser doesn't want to take ownership of his failure as a state representative and how he's one of the people responsible for Connecticut's fiscal crisis, where he's demanded more money out of the pockets of hardworking families. That's just true.
Basically, not only not apologizing, not believing that this was anti-Semitic in any way, a couple hours later, post Chelsea Clinton tweet, post Jake Tapper tweet, post calls from the Washington Post, his response says, quote, several things have come into perspective from conversations with Jewish friends, including Jewish Republicans. In a race with a Jewish candidate, this image should be recognized as offensive, raising classic anti-Semitic tropes. It cannot be justified. I personally would not have approved this mailer, and I'm grateful that the party did not approve it. I have requested to sit down with the ADL to broaden my understanding of and sensitivity to anti-Semitism.
Well, I don't feel great about the people from the ADL who are going to be able to sit down with him if that ever actually happens. Man, that was just amazingly tone deaf. And that doesn't really surprise me coming from J.R. Romano, who he really isn't that great at being somebody, as being a face of the Republican Party.
You think? No.
I think that that's an understatement. And that just it's just emblematic of the total cluelessness that the Republicans, unfortunately, have had with this particular incident. I do want to address what Kevin said a little earlier about anti-Semitism not being a new thing. And this is true. Anti-Semitism exists on the left. It exists on the right. It exists in extremist groups. And I think we have been too quick to kind of wink at it when it doesn't fit into the narratives that we want to have. And I think we, in the light of what's been happening lately, we really do need to keep a closer eye on it, not just when it suits us politically, but whenever it happens. And we need to make sure that we are calling it out.
Amen. Amen.
Kevin, what's interesting about the J.R. Romano statement afterward, clearly he has been talked to by some people in the party. This is something he wants to roll back. He doesn't want this damage to extend far beyond this particular race. It does signal, though, something that J.R. has not done very much as the head of the State Republican Party, which is in any way pivot away from the Donald Trump playbook. The Donald Trump playbook is you never apologize for anything. You just double down and
triple
down.
Well, that certainly was his initial instinct.
That was the initial instinct. But I guess I'm just wondering if it shows a bit of learning amongst some people in the party that the party in this state, and, you know, you're a former Republican representative, the party in this state isn't the party of Donald Trump. The party in this state actually is going to be more thoughtful than maybe some national Republicans. Am I wrong about that?
I wish you were not wrong about that. But what I see is, you know, you don't hear many voices criticize. Aside, you know, forget that we're in the middle of a campaign. But you don't hear many voices criticizing among the Republicans, Donald Trump. In fact, the five candidates for governor at a debate each gave, when asked to grade his presidency, each gave him an A, which was a mighty low moment.
I want to get to one quick phone call before we change topics. Tim is calling.
Could we? I'm sorry.
Hold on for a second, Tim.
This whole J.R. Romano reaction is not a surprise to anyone who has seen him on that awful Whiskey Patriots video podcast.
From which he has been scrubbed quite a bit, I think, since the Carl Higbie situation.
Yes.
He's been scrubbed out.
Yeah, that revealed his essential instincts, I think.
I want to get to Tim. Hi there, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. I wanted to talk about also the national aspect of this. When you have Kevin McCarthy, you know, essentially tweeting about the rich people trying to buy the election, and they just happen to be Soros, Steyer, and Bloomberg. That tweet went out with the whole idea, which the irony of the Republicans saying, here's some people trying to buy an election, is kind of lost on it. But that, and of course, you know, the whole Soros thing, you know, continues to be, you know, main talking point about, you know, these people, these Jewish people trying to buy the election, trying to funnel, you know, the caravan coming up. I mean, that's why the guy went in to and killed the people in the synagogue, because he thought the Jews were responsible for the caravan and the invaders. The invaders and the invaders are coming up there. So, Kevin, I guess my question is, what does the Republican National Party do as far as pivoting away from this kind of conspiracy theory kind of talk?
Well, you know, it's a good question. Every two political parties in a nation of over 300 million people, in each one you're going to have a lot of strains of thought. The problem comes when one loony one becomes, if not dominant, at least much bigger than it has been in the past. And that is what the Republicans are facing right now, is that this growing conspiracy theorist, legitimizing conspiracy theories, and that is certainly being fertilized and watered by the president of the United States. And you know, you see Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and it's madness. And so I don't have a very good answer for you, because I see these polls, and I see that 90% of Republicans approve of Donald Trump, and I think it is going to be the clock ticking that may do something about it, and some thumping defeats.
Yeah, my answer is that they can't. Not right now. That, like Kevin says, they have to, it has to be crushed. It has to be defeated. When conspiracy theories and racism and anti-Semitism combine, it's lethal. It's lethal. And it's a very sort of toxic thing that it's almost impossible to get away from. And unfortunately, to get rid of it, you have to undo the past 20 years. You have to undo the rise of fringe talk radio becoming more and more mainstream. You have to undo the rise of Fox News. All of these things that become slowly more mainstream over the past 20 years, you have to undo that. And it's like deprogramming an entire generation of young Republicans.
Colin?
Such is the dynamic of my decades-long relationship with Kevin Rennie, is that, once again, he's going to force me to stick up for Connecticut Republicans. So I just want to say, look, you know, when I'm standing there at Foxwoods, the Republican convention, surrounded by a lot of people that I know, you know, prominent Republicans who were important enough to be at the convention, whatever that means, I don't think I'm standing with a bunch of anti-Semites. I see some people walking by with some buttons and stuff that maybe scare me a little bit. But I don't think I'm standing with a bunch of anti-Semites. I think I'm standing with a bunch of good people who have different political philosophies from mine, political philosophies that are different enough so that if I want to go go there, I can sort of say, wow, that's worse than just a different political philosophy. There's something morally wrong with you. But that's not how I feel. I feel
yeah,
like.
What I'm saying is there are many strains in each political party.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And that strain of conspiracy theorists of all crazy stripes has become far more influential.
Right. And I'm very disappointed that 20 of the Republicans I respect the most didn't have a press conference yesterday and appear to have no press conference scheduled today to stand together in front of a bunch of mics and say, this was wrong. This is not who we are. We apologize to Matt Lesser. Let's move forward. You know, sometimes when you're in the middle of a campaign, you feel like a hammer and everything looks like a nail and, you know, this guy Cherema just blew it. I want to see that press conference because I want to go back to feeling about the Republicans that I share space with and time with in this state the way that I typically do, which is that I don't agree with them about a lot of stuff, but I know them to be good and decent people. I don't know why I'm not seeing them do this thing right now, and it does upset me that they haven't.
I want to take a break here now. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Kevin Rennie from Daily Ructions, his blog, and also the Hartford Current. Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about the thrilling, exciting debate that happened at maybe it wasn't that exciting. It was the last of the five debates between the contenders for governor. That race is almost at its end. We're going to find out where this race stands right now when we come back on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can call us at 860-275-7266 as we turn toward the governor's race with Kevin Rennie. He's an attorney, he's a Hartford Current columnist, and he's a blogger at dailyructions.com. Susan Bigelow is a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what is on your show today?
Well, perhaps almost alone among Connecticut journalists, I have a sympathy for and a fascination with those candidates who are not part of major parties or part of any political tradition that is easily recognizable by anybody else. And so we have a long-running thing we've been doing for about 9 years now called Get to Know Your Fringe Candidates. Today we are going to have candidates on, many of whom are things that, like, you know, registered write-in candidates and stuff like that. So because, like, nobody ever talks to them. Except me.
Do you still have the theme song?
That's the problem. They don't like being called fringe candidates. We unfortunately wrote this theme song called Get to Know Your Fringe Candidates. And then we had people like Jill Sobule record their own versions of it. And then we had Self-Suffice rap a version of it and stuff. So we've got all this music that we don't want to get rid of. So we're not changing the name.
Okay. Good. So maybe we'll hear a little bit of music this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show at 1 o'clock as well. I will also tell you that next Tuesday night, WNPR Connecticut Public Radio will be bringing you live coverage of all of the election results. Starting at 7 o'clock, we'll be telling you what's happening in Connecticut from 7 to 9 o'clock, and then we'll be joining NPR as they take us through the midterm elections for the rest of the evening on WNPR.org, on Connecticut Public Radio, and also on Facebook Live. The final debate.
Will you be breaking in for Connecticut updates?
Oh, we will
or
be.
Or should people turn to WFSB to see their lineup of people?
Their lineup. Anybody we know in that lineup of people, Kevin?
You know, Joe Ganim.
and
David Stemmerman.
And maybe somebody else. So there's going to be a lot of coverage. We will be breaking in throughout the course of the evening on WNPR. So last night was the final televised debate between Ned Lamont, Bob Stefanowski, and Oz Griebel. We're going to get to results of the Quinnipiac poll, which happened in advance of that in just a moment. But first, let's hear a little bit of a segment of last night's debate. It came near the end. News 8's Ann Nyberg, who was the moderator, challenged them with a slightly offbeat question.
15 seconds each. Your favorite politician and why?
At any time in history?
Yes.
Abraham Lincoln. Because of the leadership he provided on ending slavery and at the same time to try to keep the country united.
Mr. Lamont.
Bobby Kennedy. And let me just say that nonsense about the statewide property tax is just not true.
Stay on message, sir.
Not true.
On message.
You had your chance, Ned.
Why do you prefer Bobby Kennedy?
Because he's fearless. He stood up and thought he did what he thought was right.
All right, thank
you. Whatever the
consequences. Your favorite politician and why?
I would say Ronald Reagan. He brought hope back to America. He fixed the economy. He got taxes down.
he made. We need to start feeling proud about Connecticut again.
I actually really love that clip, Colin, because I think it tells you an awful lot about what all these debates were like. We hear Kevin in the background groaning. I don't know. Any big takeaways from last night's final televised debate?
Ooh, can we just talk about this clip for a second?
Please.
First of all, when Stefan Oskey talks about Reagan, he sort of talks like Reagan. Did you notice that?
I kind of like Ronald Reagan.
Last
time he voted. Yeah. That's why.
So that's the least Bobby Kennedy-like affirmation of Bobby Kennedy that anybody has ever made anywhere. And it's a little bit of a diagnosis on one of the problems that Ned Lamont has, which is kind of being in the moment with a message. So you get an opportunity to say Bobby Kennedy is my model, and that's a moment where you can really say something pretty forceful and persuasive about yourself if you do it well. If you try to pivot back to some grievance from 5 minutes ago about the property tax, you wind up seeming about as far from Bobby Kennedy as a politician can get and still be in the same political party with him. And so, you know, if you listen to those guys, yeah, I think, you know, you hear Oz, who has acquired down the home stretch here a kind of confidence, you know, and an ability to kind of yes. say something, you know, that sort of makes sense and is a little bit stirring that was not available to him earlier in the campaign. I don't really exactly understand what happened. Well, because remember, like in 1980, when Ted Kennedy, when he was completely wiped out of his Carter challenge, he went to the convention and gave
brilliant.
The speech
one of the
of
great
his life,
speeches of the second
was,
half of
when
the
he was in, no
20th
longer
century.
In danger of being elected president. He gave this fabulous speech, and maybe, you know, when you just know. You got nothing to lose and nothing to win. You know, you get better. But, yeah, everybody kind of was themselves in that little clip.
Kevin, what did you think about the debate as a whole?
I will tell you, John, that I boycotted last night's debate.
You boycotted it.
I have had enough.
Did you have a sign you were picketing out in front of Fox
Woods? I thought to myself at 7 o'clock, my television was on. I thought, you know, I could watch that debate. I'm not going to do it. I cannot. You saw an example here. They really refused to answer questions. And none of them will say. Oz has given a little bit of an answer, but what are you going to do about that $4.6 billion deficit? I've been posing that question, as have others, all year. We don't get anything close to a satisfactory answer.
What Kevin is trying to tell you is that last night he watched The Crown for the third time.
No, I did not. I did not watch The Crown for the fourth time.
For the fourth time. Susan, did you watch?
No, I took a nap. And I could have watched
the
debate.
You were watching and you took a nap, or you took a nap instead of watching?
No, I took a nap ahead of time. Okay. This was a pre-planned nap.
Yeah.
I just could have watched and it would have been the same result. It's just the same stuff over and over and over again. I've watched a lot of these debates. I feel like I could just pick a couple of moments from each one, smush them together, and get last night's debate. And from all reports, that's pretty much what it was. So I'm kind of glad I didn't watch. I think I would have wasted my time watching it.
I just want to pause here before we get into some of the substance of it. Well, maybe we don't have any other substance to talk about in last night's debate. But just interesting, the two of the sharpest political observers that I know in Connecticut who come on this program quite a lot. You just don't even want to watch it anymore because it's so much of the same thing.
Same thing.
I mean, are we...
I wish Ned, though, had talked about Bobby Kennedy a little bit, because, you know, that's something interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be something interesting. That would be something a little different.
Yeah.
And we don't – they're all so cautious and
because
programmed.
We spend an awful lot of time trying to figure out how to make these debates happen and making sure that we have equity amongst the different television stations that broadcast them and the right sorts of questions, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, Susan, if it matters at all.
I wonder sometimes, too. I think that the candidates could make it matter if they wanted to. But they're just so programmed. They're so cautious. They're just so dull. Nobody wants to make a mistake. Nobody wants to take a risk. And it does a disservice to the voters. They're all doing a disservice to the voters. And that's why a lot of people really don't watch the debates. I think people may have tuned in for the first one a little bit. But for the most part, people are not watching. They're getting their information about the candidates from somewhere else. Mm.
I want to just say that, and this maybe would allow us to segue a little bit into the Quinnipiac poll, that one suggestion that people don't watch the debates, or if they do watch the debates, they are not moved by it, is I think most people would agree that in recent debates, including the one that immediately preceded the time that particular poll, this this final Quinnipiac poll was in the field, Oz Griebel was in a debate where he did very well. Most observers thought he did very well, that he kind of called nonsense when nonsense was being spouted, that he seemed like an adult who had some grasp of the issues and the reality and the realities of governing. And his reward for that was to, I don't really know if he went back 7 points or whether he, the margin for error is 4. He went from 11 to 7. Who knows? Maybe he was always at 7. Maybe he's still at 11 and that's the margin of error. But he got nothing out of it. He got zero. He had a really good debate performance and he has nothing to show for it in the polls. And that might tell you something.
Well, also, the problem was he doesn't have the resources to amplify a good debate performance. He just hasn't had the money to do that. And, you know, I think I'm sure you're an example of this, but a lot of work goes into formulating the questions at a debate. I think the people on the panel work harder at being creative and thorough, probably harder than the candidates do in terms of they don't want to be creative, and they just, you know, it just defies the best questioner.
The very best moment I thought in last night's debate was, the panelists had come up with what I thought was a very good question. I'm someone who talks an awful lot on this program about how we can have easier access to voting here. A lot of other states do early voting. There's a lot of other ways in which you can get people engaged, maybe open primaries, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a question about early voting last night, and it allowed Bob Stefanowski to give an answer in which he wants to get more people voting. And Oz Griebel got to have the only real funny rejoinder of the evening, which had to do with Bob Stefanowski's previous voting record in Connecticut, which is, I thought, a very good moment prompted by a very good question. But I think you're absolutely right, Kevin. I think that we work to get questions out there to people, hold people accountable to these things. And at the end of the day, I'm not necessarily sure that it matters. And Colin, you make a great point. So Oz Griebel does well in the debate, doesn't get anything out of it. What do we see in these latest Quinnipiac poll numbers? Ned Lamont up by about the margin of error, 4 points, 47% to 43%. Oz Griebel holding city at 7%. One way to read that is that's good news for Bob Stefanowski because he's closing in on Ned Lamont. Another way to view it is, I think a lot of us thought that Ned Lamont might already be trailing Bob Stefanowski, and this might be a good result for Ned Lamont.
Yeah. First of all, the one thing I want to precede all my comments by saying, and I mentioned this on my own show on Monday, the next newspaper or headline writer who takes a poll like this and says candidates in dead heat, I'm going to charge down there and punch them because you have no idea whether the candidates are in it. I mean, if it's a 4-point lead and there's a 4-point margin of error, let's make it as easy as possible. The candidates could be tied. This candidate could be up 4 points. It could be up 8 points. And all of those things are equally possible, at least mathematically. So don't say it's a dead heat. Never say it's a dead
heat. And 4 points is not insignificant.
No.
Particularly at the end with so few undecided voters.
Yeah, right. This is, you know, like heuristically, you could sort of say, well, maybe Lamont is up 2 points and the other 2 points is sampling error or something like that. But we don't really know. It's too close a race to call. I think it has to be looked at generally is kind of a bad position for Ned Lamont to find himself in if you look over the breadth of the campaign. This is a campaign in which he's running against a guy who was living in England until recently and who doesn't vote and who's not a persuasive speaker and who has only one message and who doesn't get out on the campaign trail very much and doesn't work very hard. And go read Kevin's column from last week if you want to read some other stuff. And Ned has a built-in structural advantage. He's from the majority party by far in this state. Should be a relatively easy. He's run statewide 2 times before. He has some pretty good name recognition. The fact that he's not up 8 to 10 points is a suggestion that there's something really wrong with his campaign.
I would say that there's 2 things that are working against him. One, he's not a great candidate, and his support has always been kind of soft. He made the mistake of running for governor, I think, instead of running for Senate again. I mean, he couldn't really run for Senate again. But when he ran in 2006, he was able to make his campaign about national issues that made a lot of people, you know, they made a lot of people very excited about him. And talking about Connecticut and the governor's race, it just does not have that same effect. And he's just not as effective a candidate. Secondly, this is set up to be a more Republican cycle, or at least it should be. because people are so fed up with Dan Malloy. They're so fed up with the Democratic legislature. There's a lot of economic worry out there. Even though the economy is improving, people don't really feel it that much. So this could have been a great change election for Republicans. The fact that Stefanowski is not winning is pretty remarkable. All in all, I think this is actually not a bad poll for Ned Lamont. He is still winning pretty handily among the people who are really likely to turn out, theoretically, in this coming election, including women, minorities. He's doing very well among those people who we think are going to be turning out more. So it's not a bad position to be in. If I had to be one of these candidates, I would rather be Ned Lamont right now.
And he also has an advantage in terms of the people who have said they might vote for Oz Griebel. If they've got a second choice, there's always Ned Lamont. And he outstrips Stefanowski quite handily there in this poll. Kevin, I mean, I don't know. Is it a good poll for Ned Lamont? Is it a good poll for Bob Stefanowski?
They can each point to the poll and shape their interpretation in a way that's good for them. But I think Susan's right. I think that if three of the candidates who lost in the Republican primary had won, they'd be far ahead.
And, yeah, Mark Boughton wipes the floor with this.
Absolutely.
I would think. I don't know if that's one of the three.
You're yes, thinking. Mark Boughton, David Stemmerman, and Steve Upsitnik, I think, would have created a moment that they could have taken advantage of. And I also think we cannot underestimate this hostility to Dan Malloy that is historic. I mean, these approval numbers are really jarring that, it's not healthy for that many people in a state to dislike their leader that as much as people do.
And not just from a political perspective. I think just in general.
It's politically too. It's something is wrong. And, 4 years ago, the day before the election, I recall the Foley people saying they were 2 points ahead. Someone, another professional Republican said to me, a Republican needs to be a couple of points ahead in Connecticut going into the election because the Democrats have such a superior ground game.
The numbers just aren't in Republicans' favor.
Right. Could I say one thing about that, too?
Yeah.
That's absolutely true, and this time I think it's even truer. I don't think – because Stefanowski has been kind of a lazy candidate and a disengaged candidate, he's going to have even less of a ground game. His get-out-the-vote operation will be nil. This is not a well-run Democratic campaign, but they just structurally – they just kind of have this – it's kind of there for them to use, and that's a big problem. And I really do think that if Lamont doesn't win this – I mean, the people running this campaign should hang their heads in shame. I was sharing the resume of Mark Bradley, who's the nominal campaign manager of Ned Lamont, and one of his most recent other jobs was as a ski slope rescue guy. And one of my friends said, well, that could come in handy on election night. He might need to be strapped to a board and carried out somewhere. I mean, one of the problems with this campaign, and then I'll shut up, is that it does closely resemble 2016 presidential race. You have one candidate who's saying a lot of stuff. You have a Republican candidate who's saying a lot of stuff that really kind of isn't – it doesn't really track well with reality. I mean, like, you can't eliminate the state income tax, and he says it over and over and over again. And then you have another candidate who has no palpable overarching message. Just in the same way that ultimately people didn't know what Hillary Clinton stands for, people don't know what Ned Lamont stands for. There's no clear, cohesive, concise Ned Lamont message from the beginning of this campaign to its end. There still isn't.
It's so risky. It's so risky to tell the truth.
Well, let me get back to the numbers and what the Quinnipiac poll maybe tells us. And Colin, you and I both looked at this. I mean, if you go back and look at the last Quinnipiac poll before the 2014 election, Tom Foley and Dan Malloy, and the last one before the 2010 election, Tom Foley and Dan Malloy, we saw basically the same splits, right? Dan Malloy winning by a couple points back in 2014. It turned out that he won by a very slim margin. Tom Foley maybe up a couple points in 2010. Turns out Dan Malloy beat him by like a bucketful.
6,000 votes.
Yeah, by like as many votes as you could put in a Halloween candy bag.
So first of all.
Or a bag in Bridgeport's register of voters office.
Well played.
So wherever you are, whoever you are, you should absolutely vote. This is probably going to be a very close election. So you absolutely should do that. Yeah, I mean, the one kind of error bell that's ringing on the Q poll from 2014 is they had Joe Visconti with eight points. He got 1% of the vote. He did sort of, I think, kind of drop out
he
of the race.
Dropped out the Sunday before.
Does that make 7 points go away? I think there's a little bit of a problem.
And those third party candidates who do register in polls tend to fade at the the end.
Yeah, and I don't know. We talk a lot about the Oz-Griebel impact. I mean, 7 points in this poll. How many people show up to actually vote for Oz-Griebel on Tuesday? It's suggested, Susan, that these voters might be pulling away from Ned Lamont more than pulling away from Bob Stefanowski. How much of an impact does this have?
I think it does have an impact. The way that I read this poll is I read some of Stefanowski's increase in percentage. He went up from like 38 to 42, something like that. Some of that was voters who were going for Griebel but who were kind of inclined towards Stefanowski, kind of coming home to Stefanowski. I think that's at least part of it. And the ones who are more interested in voting for Lamont, I don't think that they've quite gotten there yet, but I think that they're going to when they get into the voting booth. This is it's such a hard thing to run as a third-party candidate, and it's hard if you're somebody who does support and like a third-party candidate who's not doing well, because then when you get into the voting booth, you have this awful choice. Do I vote for the candidate that I actually like and who I think is going to run the government better, or do I hold my nose and vote for my second choice?
Well, and this gets me to one last point before we have to take a quick break. Kevin, you write for, Colin, you write for the Hartford Courant, which came out with an endorsement over this past weekend for that third-party candidate, Oz Griebel. Maybe, as we've said before, the debates as we've currently structured them don't matter as much as we think they do. What about the debate from the paper of the endorsement from the paper of record in the state?
Well, first of all, Colin and I have nothing to do with it.
Yes, that is absolutely true.
We read it when you read it. At least I read it when Colin, maybe.
Me too.
And I was not surprised. I thought it would be either – I knew it wouldn't be Bob Stefanowski since he'd never – he won't go see them. But, you know, the current I think endorsed Lowell Weicker in 1990 and Eunice Gorick in 1994 – and
John Anderson for president in 1980.
Oh, okay, John Anderson for president. And
not the guy from Yes, John.
And I believe Joe Lieberman when he ran as an independent.
Yeah.
So there's some tradition of that those third-party candidates or those independent candidates. And I think Oz has that kind of Eunice Gorick kind of Greater Hartford very unhappy, formerly moderate Republican.
I don't think the endorsements really matter. I just don't. I think that people will read them in the Courant and be like, okay, that's interesting, and go back to voting who they were going to vote for anyway.
The one way that they – first of all, Kevin and I would also like to take this opportunity to tell you that we have this yearly imposed blackout this week. So he and I will not be writing about Matt Lesser or Bob Stefanowski or anything like that.
It's not because we don't care.
Yes. So Kevin's essay praising Claire Foy will be in lieu of his usual
political
commentary.
And I'm outraged that at the wage gap that she suffered.
All right. So – and I'll just quickly say, they don't matter unless you can – we're back to what Kevin said before. If you can make use of them in a residual way. Now, for Oz Griebel, who's having trouble raising money, it's probably a little too late for him to raise much more money. But you could take something like that. Gorick did it, I think, in 1994. You can take something like that and go to donors and say, see, I have some kind of traction here. Give me some money.
I want to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about enthusiasm or not in the state as we head toward Election Day. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant and DailyRuxions.com. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, Susan Bigelow, and Kevin Rennie. I want to get to a quick phone call here before we move on. Kate's calling from West Hartford. Hey, Kate.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I happen to be married to the Democratic Registrar of Voters in West Hartford.
Okay.
And they have had just a huge number of registrations come in the last few days, very high numbers, 350 that they processed in the last 2 days. And that was not the stuff that had come in over the weekend. And he was exhausted when he came home. And I'm a municipal employee in another town, and they, too, have been getting lots and lots of last-minute registrations. So I think the enthusiasm level or interest in voting is high.
Did they have a lot of walk-ins yesterday?
Kevin was just asking you, Kate, a lot of walk-ins?
Yes,
yesterday was the last day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of walk-ins.
Yeah. Hey, Kate, thank you very much for that. And again, there's this weird rule in Connecticut that if you want to vote and register on Election Day, you can, but you don't do that at the polling place. You do that at the pre-prescribed place in town,
the town clerk's office.
Usually.
Or participating Red Lobster.
And I've got a coupon, actually. Yeah. It's a 2-for-1 lobster day. I don't know. Are you hearing similar stories of enthusiasm, people registering? We've seen the numbers are going up. People are registering to vote, Susan.
Yeah. I was emailing back and forth with Gabe Rosenberg at the Secretary of the State's office. The numbers, and this was before yesterday, the numbers for both Republicans and Democrats registering in a midterm year are just through the roof compared with the last couple of cycles, compared with, you know, 2006 even, compared with 2010, compared with 2014. It's just a massive surge of new registrations. And it's for both parties. It's not just Democrats. It's for both parties. So there is a lot of interest. There's a ton of interest. And that makes these races very unpredictable.
I have been doing an informal survey of contacts there has been a surge of Democratic absentee ballots, according to my informal survey. It's always a problem for Republicans. They are terrible at absentee ballots. Democrats are very good at absentee ballots. And those are locked down and ready to be counted.
Although I had heard on Friday that unfortunately, I think the key to cities and for Democratic votes is a huge number of absentee ballots. And I think that they're behind their usual pace in all three major cities. That's what I was told on Friday. Like, it could have changed even since then. I think there's a difference between enthusiasm and interest, you know? And so I think this is kind of a low – I don't – like, you know, Ned Lamont really isn't Bobby Kennedy. So, like, people had a lot of enthusiasm about Bobby Kennedy. There's people who are outraged. There are people who dread certain outcomes. There are people who feel as though everything that's happened to and with women requires and motivates them to vote in this situation. I would say outside of maybe Johanna Hayes and a few other examples, this is not an enthusiasm election. This is, I better participate or I'm going to get stuck with another bowl of crap, you know, for 2 years.
I don't think we've had an enthusiasm election since 2008, really. I think we have been voting not for somebody, but against outcomes that we don't want, against things that we dread and fear almost every single time, with some really very few exceptions. I think that the election of Barack Obama was the last election where people were really enthusiastic about a candidate.
I will just read from Jacqueline Rabe Thomas' story in the Connecticut Mirror, though Colin had mentioned Johanna Hayes maybe getting people excited in the 5th Congressional District. She writes, since the last midterm election in 2014, an additional nearly 5,000 new Democrats under age 25 had registered to vote in the 5th District as of last Thursday, compared to just about 2,600 additional Republicans. That really is a big surge. Now, of course, that is a district in which it seems, Kevin, as though Johanna Hayes will win relatively easily. I'm not sure what that means for Ned Lamont or other Democrats.
I think it's a problem for Republicans. The enthusiasm for Johanna Hayes in Litchfield County, everyone tells me, it is unprecedented. And, you know, a Republican candidate for governor needs to come out of Litchfield County with some numbers. And that may blunt their how well they do.
They know they've got a superstar on their hands. I mean, at least so far. I mean, she's got a long way to go to prove who she really is as a member of Congress and who she really is in a durable way. But right now, they have somebody with absolutely unquestionably telegenic charisma, and that's gold, and particularly in a situation like this where people are demoralized and are mostly unhappy about their choices. This is a choice a lot of people are happy about.
Yeah, and at least there's something that's positive happening in this election. This feels like another miserable slog of an election. And I don't know. I mean, I worry every time when we have a really nasty, negative, bitter, and demoralizing election, just how much more that erodes democracy.
There's been no optimism. And the bright spot has been Johanna Hayes. Mm-hmm. She's done us all a favor, first by defeating Mary Glassman and now by winning on Tuesday. What? It's true.
Kevin Rennie.
You're snickering at me.
No, I had a cough.
Kevin Rennie blogs at DailyRuctions.com.
You're all in her debt.
You can read more of his insight at DailyRuctions.com and also in the Hartford Current. Thanks so much, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Susan Bigelow, contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you, Susan.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR.
Thank you, Mr. Dankosky.
And, of course, me and Colin. Well, we're going to be finishing that long slog next Tuesday night with live coverage here on WMPR. Thanks to producer Scott Brady, executive producer Katie Talarski, Carlos Mejia, Kion Wolf, and Penina Beattie, who helped to put together today's show. This is The Wheelhouse.